I can't get these memories out of my mind, and some kind of madness has started to evolve.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Authentic,
where we get authentic.
My name is Nicholas Thomas Fitzsimmons Vandenhabel, but most people just know me as Nick. And with me, as always, is my dog Marla.
Marla! Come here, baby! Say hello to the listeners!
Oh, I guess it would be nice if I could lick your body and chew all of your heads up, cause you know I love you. Baby, you gotta have faith, faith, faith. You gotta have faith. Faith, faith.
All right, that's enough, Marlon. Go back to chewing on my aviators and my Levi's blue jeans. So, on Authentic, if you've never listened to us before, we explore all things recovery. What do I mean by that? All things recovery. Well, it's the idea. If you are still living and breathing on this earth, you, yes, you are in recovery from something. Myself, I'm in recovery from chemical dependency. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I'm a compulsive gambler. I mean, really, the list could go on and on and on and on. The point is that I've addressed it. I have come to a place of recovery. And now my purpose is to be of help. And if I help one person, then I have done my job today. And that's why we are here in the studio today. We are here to help one person. With me in the studio to talk about his experience, strength, and hope as it pertains to chemical dependency is Dwight. Dwight, how you doing, brother?
Doing well, bud. Thank you for having me.
Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? They know your name, but who are you?
Well, I'm Dwight C. I am an alcoholic and a drug addict. I'm a 60-year-old man from Aspen, Colorado, currently residing in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Aspen. Today in Minneapolis with you.
Right on. Welcome to the show, my friend.
Good to be here.
You are here to talk about chemical dependency. Why?
Well, why I'm here to talk about it is because it's good for me, always cathartic to speak about that, speak about the truth of my situation before and now. You know, we're going to take a shot if we can help somebody else. That's really what it's all about.
When did your usage start?
Oh, my.
Yeah. I didn't tell you I was going to hit you with that one.
I'll repeat, I am a 68-year-old man. It's a while back, but I can certainly tell you. I was just a high school drinker, and so there was really no big relationship with that. I did not one of those people that found God or confidence or all that stuff. That just wasn't my experience. I certainly understand it, and I've heard it. Okay? There are variables, my grandmother was an alcoholic, and my mother and father both. I did not have a traumatic experience with that. Their alcoholism developed more after I had left the home at 18, and I never really lived there again, actually. Not for that reason. I just didn't live in the cities with them. But certainly I understand their genetic relationships. I acknowledge that there probably must be. I would never point to that as my defining fact. So drug usage actually started, it was 1969, the fall of 1969, and going into 1970. And the reason I point that out, I might have made some decisions that others wouldn't make. I was in Austin, Texas. This was the prime time of Haight-Ashbury, San Francisco, Austin, Texas. It was wide open, and we were trying anything and anyone. I was doing the drinking cheap wine at parties thing, attempting to go to college, running around with the LSD crowd, those kind of things. Lots of people doing that, not just me. I didn't start it. Where maybe I'm different from the average amateur is my first drug of choice that cleared up most of my drug choices was heroin. South Texas, it was there. Somebody brought it over, started with smoking it, found a lot of ease and comfort there. So again, again, probably not the normal choice that people listening might make, but that was there. That's a very powerful and highly addictive drug.
Do you think that's indicative of what the rest of your usage looked like? Go straight for the hard shit?
Perhaps, yeah.
That quick fix, what's going to get you there fastest?
Yes, that certainly became the model later, both then and then. Yeah, it certainly did. Quickest, fastest is not an unusual trait in an alcoholic or addict. So yes, the checkout, fast factor, high impact.
Where was heroin and other substances taking you?
It would put me into a cocoon of feeling. And we've heard drinkers or people talk about more confident. I can't tell you that I was an insecure mess walking around without it, but I sure liked where it put me. I did. You do things, but you don't deal with things much, you see. They call the drug, in a class, it's euphorics, you know, it's a warm cocoon of euphoria. You feel good for no apparent reason, nothing much has to happen or not happen. It's all on its own. Certainly, you know, being an 18-year-old, and I'm sure that I certainly felt confident, though. I can't say it's the confidence I'd never had, but it was the next level thing. It was. I liked the way I felt, and I liked the way I acted out there, yeah.
How long did your use of heroin last? A lot of people are thinking these days, the stigma around heroin use, the thought that immediately comes to mind is somebody laying on their bed with a needle in their arm. You were functional, it sounds like.
When I wasn't, it took me to laying on a bed with a needle in my arm. So there you go. You
know? Right, right. Yes. But what I'm saying is it didn't start like that.
No, we were just college kids messing around with something way over our heads. But no, just a bunch of young goofs.
How long did you use heroin for?
I used it in a strong fashion, got massively addicted. Again, went from the smoking to the needles very fast. Don't recall it. We're talking about 50 years ago. But very quickly, it was just guys experimenting about this, how about that, and next thing you know, we're doing it. Went from high functioning for a short time to low functioning in college. Couldn't even finish the year. Never went back. I would say about a year and a half, almost 2 years at the right around there. Yeah, 2 years. I dealt with that. The many on and offs, the lower companion, East Austin street scoring, the selling of drugs or pot to make money to do this. Yeah. And if there's, you think about stigmas in 1969 or 70, I mean, it was not unheard of. Well, just like a lot of addictions today, I find it more understood. We certainly read about an opiate crisis and heroin crisis more in the news now. There was a stigma. You didn't tell your friends. You didn't, other than your fellow heroin using friends, you did not tell girls or anybody, oh, by the way, did I tell you I'm a recreation heroin user? That was, the stigma was there. It was this big deal. Not to mention to law enforcement, that was in the state of Texas, that was a fast track to prison if you wanted to. I got lucky.
At the end of your heroin use, you said that you used pretty hard for a year and a half.
Yeah.
Why did that end?
I had bottomed out.
What did bottoming out look like?
Health-wise, et cetera. You know, I was very young, so I was physically stronger to rebound than I would be at 68.
For those out there that don't necessarily understand the adverse physical effects of long-term heroin use and coming off of that, how would you explain that?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, sure. I would say those can picture having the flu, and the flu is not a bad cold. It's the flu is the flu, and it hurts, and you hurt badly. Heroin opiates are very, interestingly enough, give people energy. Somebody says, no, he seemed too happy. I'm probably high. It's the other way around, but boy, that coming off, there's no energy. There's lethargy, bad flu-like symptoms to the extreme, like not functioning type thing. When your body, it's like suffocating. Your body wants it that badly. For most people, it's pretty hard to get off and stay off for any length of time. I've found rehabs and detoxes to help somebody get a running head start, but it's a process. I had tried it. I can quit. I quit it hundreds of times. I don't know how many times I quit in that period of time. I also had the option, as I got clear of it, that I do not have today, because we'll talk about my story. I just drink alcohol. You say, I wasn't aware of it. I was substituting at this time. I'm 19 years old, 20 years old maybe at the most. You know, I was out of college. As I recall, pretty much dragged out in the apartment, running out of, I couldn't work because of my condition, and I was out of money. And I grew up in a family of parents, and God bless them, it was the best thing they ever did for me, is if you're not doing this, you get a job. That's what you do. You know, we don't support people, much less drug addicts. You know, somewhere in that thing, I knew it had to stop. I was totally naive to any recovery. This had zero to do with recovery. Okay, I don't even know if I'd heard the word of any of these recovery programs in AA, any of them. I just never.
What you're looking at right now is purely physical consequences for drug use.
Correct.
That was purely the reason.
Yeah. Well, a miserable life. Yeah, miserable life, bad health. I just don't recall. It was almost, and this, it's not recovery. It's just a pull yourself up by the bootstraps, crazy story. That's all it is. I did it by, okay, I'm quit. I'm clean. Was able to get a job that I was excited about with some people. And all I said to myself was, okay, I will never look at that stuff or tell anyone, ever mention that this ever happened. And I'm going to work.
It never happened.
Kind of, but it did.
That's what you put out into the world around you. Is that accurate?
Yeah, kind of.
It didn't happen.
Like a mental geographical,
sure,
people tell you about it. And it was geographical. I went to work in Dallas with some people. I left Austin. It was to often reappear on the radar. But I said, I'm not going to. I mean, I'm just telling this story, not a recommendation. It was a naive 19, 20-year-old's method of doing things. I had good willpower back then. Hard thing, and I'm going to pour myself into work, and I'm going to do well, and I'm not going to mention that word to anybody that I either did or would like to. That's really, it was all the only tool I had. And, by the way, I get to drink alcohol.
Great segue into my next question. I was like, oh, man. We're going to be talking about boozing pretty quick here. You kicked this heroin thing. Let's not talk about it. It never happened. What happens next? Obviously, there's more to this story. What was your continued experience with substances, as you said earlier, to replace heroin? What were you using next and why?
Over the next 20 years, I was to try this or try that during the cocaine craze, those things. Wasn't what I would call my thing, alcohol. Alcohol was my replacement. Once again, you know, I didn't know I was replacing. I just thought I drank. That's what I did. I worked with an exciting new company, that restaurant business thing, and that was starting their first places in Dallas and then to Houston and Atlanta. So they provided me geographical moves. And again, different period, different time, the environment around me and the people around me drank a lot. I would say that I drank alcoholically, though. Yes, I drank with a lot of people that drank a lot. A lot of them aren't with us anymore. I was one of the last couple around every night.
You say that you drank alcoholically.
Sure.
Is that a hindsight assessment?
Absolutely.
Or is that something you thought in the moment? You're like, holy shit, I'm drinking alcoholically. In my experience, I used to say that out loud. It was a joke because I worked in the service industry. I was a bartender.
Right.
And the joke going around always was, by the book, if you have three or more alcoholic drinks a day, you clinically are an alcoholic. And that was the big joke. It's like, oh, well, we have three drinks before we even walk in the door.
Three drinks to get ready to start drinking.
That's right. So you said that you drank alcoholically. That was a hindsight comment. Where did your alcoholism really take you as time progressed? How did it move on that bell curve?
No, it did not occur to me. It is a total hindsight. It did not occur to me, the three-drink checklist, you know, I blew through daily from the 70s on till 1990. No, it occurred to me consciously once, and I remember where and when in 1980. That's literally when I said, oh boy, this is a problem.
Do you remember the moment?
What was that moment? Yeah. I mean, I drank heavier and heavier. I own bars and restaurants, and I was in and out. You know, we can talk about where it took me in that time, even up to 1980. I owned a place in Atlanta. I had a couple of guy investors, but I was the principal guy, and we had some people arriving at a specified time to meet with us, and it was important. I recall this. It had to do with interest or funding or investing in maybe taking this bigger. So it was important. It was important to my partners that I was be there. Could have been really important to me. I think I was pretty excited about it. I was the operating partner, etc. We were doing quite well. Let's just say I didn't drink when I worked at that point. I just drank like crazy when I wasn't, though. Let's say, let's just pick a time they were supposed to be there at 6 p.m., which at that on that particular schedule of time that I was working was happy hour. It was cocktail hour, as we'd call them then. Certainly, as it turns out, by my body clock, it was time to get going. Principal, I wasn't going to drink unless they did, so I didn't drink. Problem was, they had come in. They were coming from out of the country or something, and they were running late. And I wasn't going to drink. I didn't. But the later they were, the more irritated I got. I can remember this. I got irritated and agitated. I didn't have shakes yet. I was just amped up and upset. And I was sitting at a certain angle at a table in our kind of food area of the place. And I could see the part of the bar, the service bar, that I would usually walk up to as soon as I was ready to clock out or leave. And I would tell this guy, Michael, okay, you know, he'd already have the vodka chilled. So I am literally preoccupied with where the hell are they? I'm looking at the service bar. Then do I just go tell them to get it going? I like to put the air brakes on the day, man. I'd bring it to a halt. And that meant about two tumblers of vodka real quick. And then I'd roll up my sleeves and go out and have a drink with people. Probably I had to prime the pump by then. That was the way. That's where, again, it was alcoholism. I just thought, you know, I just like to get right before I'd start drinking with other people. I get real social, but I needed to get handled.
I want you to say that again, because emphatically, that is such a powerful thing to say. I had to get right.
That's what I called it back then. Yes, I had to get right. I was later in recovery in our book. And to find out through chapters and the doctor's opinion, et cetera, what that was about. But that was quite a long time later than 1980. But yes, I had a clock and I set it right. And I would walk out and greet customers and have drinks or people were waiting for me. There was always something. I had a thing and I had to have X amount of alcohol. Again, up until this night, I didn't identify this, but I did right then. In this case, like I said, it's at least one tumbler of ice down, just straight vodka, let it water down and drink it. Maybe two, and then it was just like my whole body and being would go, ah. Yeah, you know the feeling. Saw your eyes.
I just did the breath with you, brother.
Yes, everybody knows it who's been there. They know it. I mean, from nose to toes. Then I go, okay, let's go see who's here. Giddy up. Let's do it. At this moment, in this anxiousness, looking at Michael at the service bar, thinking, do I just go get the thing, the thing? I go, wow, I know this. I know this. And you're asking about the immediacy of the opiates and the whether it's shooting it, snorting it, the immediate whammo, etc. I put the two together sitting there. I said, I know this. I need this. I've done this. I said, wow, I got a problem. This is a problem. And I should do something about it. Took me 10 more years, though. Took me 10 more years. And it got way worse. Yeah. Yeah. But I know the night that I ID'd it personally, said, this is just like that, Doc. This is what you were doing. This is what you were doing 10 years ago.
I just heard something completely insane come out of your mouth.
Nothing new.
Right. It's an insane comment that I've said myself. I knew in that moment that I had a problem, yet I continued to use substances. I continued to drink and use for 10 more years.
Mm-hmm.
That identification was made when I was 20 years old, when my father, who's a drug and alcohol counselor, was dropping me off at home, hands me a slip of paper and says, Nick, I want you to look at this. And it was these 20 questions.
Mm-hmm.
And if you answer yes to a certain number of those questions, you are probably an alcoholic or a drug addict. I answered yes to every single one of those 20 questions. I thought this person, whoever wrote these questions, was following me. They know me. They know me better than I know myself. Right. And these 20 questions, I was just explained in 20 questions on a piece of paper that my dad handed me. Yet, I drank for 9 more years. And my only explanation for this insane thinking and these insane actions was I wasn't done. I hadn't heard enough yet.
Right.
That's something that my dad always used to say to me, especially later on in my alcoholism when he could see that I was falling apart. Hasn't heard enough yet, has it, Nick? No, Dad, it hasn't.
We see it all the time. Just hadn't heard enough. My mind, the addictive mind, the whatever, says, well, I'll just be really careful. I'll just do this. Maybe once the horse is out of the barn and I've discovered it, it's in the conscience somewhere, but I can drink that away. I can excuse that away. Problem was, is with over the next decade, I try to excuse it away myself, but the people around me or the relationships I was in, they quit excusing it. Like for a lot of us, my life got smaller. It wasn't too many years before I didn't have the business or the first wife or those things to worry about anymore. They start leaving.
Shouldn't people show you this unconditional love, your wife and your best friends? Aren't they supposed to stick by your side no matter what till death do us part, Dwight?
Yeah.
Were you pissed?
I was pissed, exactly. I was probably pissed. Later in life and in recovery, you know, and I got to realize, first of all, they did. They tried to. It wasn't a choice they wanted to make. You see, and I would think, yes, then I thought how hard it was for me. Getting a chance to change, get sober, and then get into recovery, I got to discover how hard it was for them. It's a pill to swallow at first, but it sure feels good. Got to tell them that, most of them, some of them. Got to tell them that. We wear people out. Guys like me, with the way I use, we're going to wear people out. They can't, and I get it.
I wear people out. I knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
Yet I did it anyway. I never had that thought that I am wearing people out It was all about me. All I thought I was doing was harming myself. So don't worry about me. I'll take care of it. I got this. And when I'm ready to stop, I'll stop.
Some people don't understand the problem and also it wears them out. Some people do understand it and it still wears them out. To be honest, you know, I wear them out with the pathetic use. I wear them out with the excuses. I wear them out in relationships with the behaviors I did. I did things like run around with girls I shouldn't run around with. I did stuff. I wore them out with my three-ring circus of BS is what I wore them out with, too. That's what it gets to, and that's really, you know, was a cathartic thing that got me to go get help, was that I wore myself out. There was an event that brought it right into my face. I was addicted to alcohol. I was at the bottom of the cycle. It was kind of scary because I had to drink to stay stable, but I didn't know when I would black out or things like that. So I knew that was bad. My liver was hurting. As I mentioned before, I had a funny tinge of yellow. But that didn't, none of that scared me, I don't think. It was physically all unpredictable and all those events and things. Probably things like that had happened before. Legal stuff, none of that. It really got it. It was self-hatred. Again, I was saying we wear people out. I had a morning. I was in Dallas-Fort Worth area where I'd grown up. I haven't lived there much, but in the same city where my mother, my father, my brother lived. And I was supposed to meet my brother at my mother and father's home to do something. I don't recall. I was supposed to meet him. And being what I was up to and who I was and who I am with this three-ring circus of alcoholism and patheticness, I was running late because that's what I do. And on the way, I am in my brain doing what I do, which is to come up with some thing that's part of my circus, and it generally evolves into, you wouldn't believe what happened to me. You understand? I mean this. This is what I was doing. I don't remember any about the story. I just know where I was and on the driveway. And it was December 1990, and I'm, again, massively addicted to alcohol, physically a mess. But I'm showing up late with the thing about you wouldn't believe what happened to me type thing. And my brother was waiting for me. And he was leaning on the car doing something. And I start presenting my thing, my situation. And my brother wasn't reacting that day particularly. You know, I mean, they all knew I was in trouble. You know, but we were used to it. He wasn't really reacting much to that. And my spiel that I was giving, you wouldn't believe what happened to me. And this is why I'm late again. And in that moment, in his whatever he was doing or not doing, maybe he had some Al-Anon under his belt. I don't know, but it doesn't matter. He wasn't really reacting to me. He goes, wow, yeah, he's nodding. And I just start crying. And I went, I can't stand this. I don't know why. I didn't have what he had, which is not sobriety. This unemotional, not angry, just nodding at me. And I'm going, I could hear myself and go, oh my God. I just can't stand this. Everybody could discuss around the problem or had a problem. Don't you want to do something about your problem? But this, I just like stopped and I said, oh my God, I just can't stand myself. I can't stand this. He's like, wow, okay, cool. He's nodding at me again. I said, so you think you're ready? You want some help? I mean, you can do it. We try to get you out. You know, you just don't take it. You ready? I said, I think I am. I'll do anything. But it really came from this self-hatred moment. I've been running that jive for a decade. That just enacted a process of, okay, well, Dad's, who was dabbling in AA at that moment, was to sober up for the rest of his living life, thank God, and had a friend who came and talked to me, know who he was, said there was help. I knew this, by the way. I knew it on some level, but it felt like the first time anybody was ever telling me.
Self-hatred came to a point where you said, I can't stand it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Can't stand me.
Oddly enough, when you can't stand yourself anymore, that is a step in the right direction. We're going to take a little break. We will be right back with How Dwight Got Some Help.
Don't beat it!
Welcome back to Authentic, where we are getting authentic with Dwight C. We have made it through experience, and now the ride really begins. We are going to talk about some strength. We are going to talk about how you got help, Dwight. So at the end of the last segment, you talked about this moment in your parents' driveway where your brother was just nodding along and you came to this realization.
Yes.
You came to this realization that it was time to get help and that yes. there was a possibility. What happened next?
Well, you know, I was realizing the problem had been discussed. I know this, and they had gotten me some help. I'd gone to treatment, and listen, I forgot, it's been so long ago, this part. I didn't even know what I was there for other than I was bad and left, you know, and whatever I did. So this moment, this morning, I think I not only hit a point of, again, I couldn't stand listening to this circus I ran, the lies I told, but also that it just sunk in deeply that there's just nothing I can do about this. There's nothing I've done, have done, been told or cajoled, you know, that was fixed me. I felt truly hopeless. I wasn't, in telling him I couldn't stand this and couldn't stand myself, I wasn't saying, you know, will you fix it? I was just expressing a real hopelessness at that moment. That's what I was expressing. It's like a gift, you know, it's a gift. I do remember that. I wasn't saying, did you guys help me thing? I mean, I gladly took the idea that they loved me and would say, you ready to try to give up? I'd read a thing in a book, and it was religious literature of some sort, and that doesn't matter where it was from. It was a Catholic writer. He wrote about the topic of grace. We've heard people say, through the grace of God, but we've heard about moments of grace, etc. And he wrote about these moments people can get. Again, I guess, what is it? Theologian. That's what he was. Doesn't matter where it came from. And he said, sometimes there is a strong collision, a cataclysmic collision between who you deep down inside wanted to be and maybe are in nature and this massive realization of where you are and what you are right now. As I choked last night, I can't put lipstick on this pig anymore. It's not going to help, you see? And so I think that was, by that description of what this theologian wrote, was what that moment, that occurrence felt like. There's this massive collision of somebody that's grown up with me, and I know who I am, who my good intentions want to be. And this reflective moment I had with him and what was coming out of my mouth, it was like my whole current life flashing before my eyes. And there is a collision of self-hatred, but grace, I don't know. It just opened a window for me. I was to experience this later in life. We'll talk about it. But I so realized I was looking at him and his reactions and things. And it was so what I didn't have, but wanted. Who I thought I was. So no more excuses. I meant to be. I was going to do. Know that. I was this giant feeling of who I'm not and who I wanted to be. And I just didn't have it. And I didn't have any solutions. Couldn't fix it. Didn't have any answers. Nothing. So you're kind of left with, thank you for even opening a window to talk about help. Almost 30 years ago, but it's pretty clear. I can remember that feeling.
The window is open. What happens when you go through it?
I had to just walk in with an unknowing spirit. I was in terrific health. I was in horrible condition. So that had to be attended to first. Our big book says, you know, first we have to, I don't know if the words, cleanse body and mind. And I was a situation of addiction, alcohol, painkillers, but body that was going south, liver that was on the downturn, things like that. I really didn't know other than the names of, it was treatment, or in this case, it was a Minnesota. I was in Texas, I came to Minnesota. That's why, another reason I'm here today. It's another home. But addiction, AA, those were just things I'd seen or read. I really didn't. And I'm sure people had probably spoken to me about, but somehow it just never registered. I assume that goes on in the world today. I don't know. You know, I take for granted that it's everyday stuff to people, and they know it's there and they should come and all these things, but maybe they don't. I know I talk to families and they don't know sometimes, families of people like me. I pretty much had to surrender myself to them physically, listen to information. I was told by a counselor at this treatment center, a great place, I was very fortunate. Family was willing to help me because I was running out of gas. That means jobs, money, everything. Everything was coming to an end after a pretty successful life until I started burning it down, which is what I do. Anyway, he informed me that he had a chart out of addiction, clinical chart. This didn't come from recovery literature, called a Jelinek chart, and he pointed to it, and it was a chart of the progressiveness of what addictions look like, and it had a big circle, and as I mentioned before, the top side was the beginning, and it wasn't too bad, and the bottom side was bad. Bad news. And I was bottom side at the end of the cycle. And he told me, sir, he said, listen, you are by this definition a chronic late stage alcoholic. And I was like, okay, probably hard to argue. And he said, and what this means is you can never drink safely again. And I remember that. That's how he put it. And it's well put, now that I understand. See, you know, I hear the term, people say, well, I can never drink again, or I never drink. Okay, that's true. But he said, you will never drink safely again. Your body, you're chronic. You have a chronic condition.
How did that statement from that counselor hit you differently than if someone said to you, Dwight, this is where you're at. You're at the bottom of this circle,
mm-hmm.
and you should never drink again. You should never mm-hmm. drink again, Dwight. Instead, he said that. What would have happened if he said what I said? You should never drink again, Dwight.
I'd heard that. But what you just said, I'd heard. I'd heard it from the family physician and that I saw when I was back in Dallas. I'd heard that. I'd heard people say it. You should never drink, or you should never drink again. I had a physician poking on my liver, and I'm saying, ouch, and he says, you should never drink again.
You can never drink safely again. What did that mean to you?
Well, it made me ask maybe a bit more of a question. You know, he caught me in a very willing window. You gotta remember, willing for me. I learned how to become more willing. At that moment, at that time, I'd had zero success in any type of quitting. You'd have to lock me up in an institution, which could be a treatment center, hospital, or jail, for me to have any length of sobriety in 2 decades. So,
what sort of successes did you start to have once you got that ball rolling?
I learned how to say yes. I learned that I learned and felt that I was in a very dire situation. I was sober, not drinking, conscious enough to care. They had me in an institution, 9 days, 15 days clean, and in a health condition that it felt dire, and I felt like I didn't want it to happen. That's where they had me, and I had me. I didn't just have a bottom and know how to quit. You know what I mean? I didn't hate myself and know how to quit. I needed help, and I was starting to understand, not consciously like I do today. Today I know I need help always. At that time, it was dire enough. It was the old saying, there's an old recovery saying, I'd run out of ideas. I knew this. I'd run out of ideas. I thought maybe I'll take suggestions, which is a whole new behavior in MO.
Generally speaking, why do you think it has to come to that for most people? These dire situations. You're being told by physicians and people around you,
right. Hey,
you're gonna die. It is that point. You are going to die. And there was a decision that had to be made. But why? Why does it have to come to that? In your opinion, why does it have to come to that?
That's certainly an age-old question and an age-old fact that we see most of the time. We see this. I'm telling you, it's my story, so there you go. But in the thousands of meetings I'm in, I've heard it all the time. I think we are self-willed individuals. Certainly, you know, so there's part of me that just thinks I can figure it out. I don't need people telling me. I think it's extremely naive, and certainly addiction, as we say, addiction talks to people. So, you know, in its own special way, talk to many a person who's come out of a detox for whatever thing they've been on. Say, I think I got this. I want to go away. And today I can hear the addiction talking that says, no, you want a drink or a drug is what you want. You want to check out. You're just right here. You're not with us yet, 100%. That's certainly one tip I give to people who recover with and without treatment centers all the time. Hey, whatever your journey is, one tip of the hat is they give somebody a minute to get that brain a little clearer to maybe make a better decision than I could make 1, 2, 3 days off of alcohol. But we do see it all the time. Why does it have to come to this? I don't know. I was not aware that I ran my life thinking that I made the decisions in life for myself, the pull yourself up by the bootstraps mentality. Don't think it's that uncommon. We don't want to. A lot of us, a common occurrence is, I can have nothing going on in my life. And as a matter of fact, did have nothing going on a consequence at that time and still think I'm too busy to take time for myself to try to recover. It's a phenom, baby. It is.
You're telling my story, brother.
It happens all the time.
All the time. And you just got to laugh.
Not a little. All the time.
And people that aren't addicts, they look at people like us that are addicts and drunks, and they are just blown away. Why are you laughing? This shit ain't funny. But to us, that's part of the deal. You gotta.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just gotta laugh about it.
It's part of recovery. Our stories can be, our darkest past can be our greatest stories. A guy can ask me how I know this, that he wants to drink, and he doesn't think he does. I guess I've done it. I don't have a better thing to tell you. I've done this. I live it every day. I get to see it every day with what I do and spend time in, but I've also done it. That's my experience. I've tricked myself.
In your experience coming to Minnesota, there was a toolkit laid at your feet. What was in this toolkit?
At that time, and again, it's a long time ago, it was December 1990, 91, I got to hear some of what people had tried to tell me and just listen to some recommendations, really. I didn't know the path. I didn't know it. I wasn't coming back from sobriety or the journey or AA and this just happened. No, I didn't. Really know. It was something they were recommending. The truth is that you should not return your environment to Texas, to anywhere. You need long-term help. You've been checked out of this world for quite a while. I knew this, but I still fought it. But in my heart, I knew it. I know I'm going to say yes, but let me fight with it for right now. Let me think that I'm too busy or something. But so that's what it was, really the toolkit that was put in front of me. How about you do this next? How about you stick around with us for a little while? How about we get you some choices and you think about this?
I just heard a lot of verbs.
Yes, some actions.
And that is so key because one thing that is very common that you hear over and over and over again from people in recovery or people that are struggling going in and out of using is, I know.
Oh, boy.
I know. Yeah. And it's not a knowing problem. Mm-mm. It's a doing problem. What were you doing?
Well, I showed up there in the treatment center, and they recommended that I do some kind of, at the very least, live in some kind of sober setting, you know, the next thing. Again, I'd certainly not said yes to anything that anybody had suggested to me up until then and felt pretty dire. So I landed at a sober house in Minneapolis. I said, yes. I just said, yeah, I'll go. Sure.
What was helpful in that setting?
Oh, wow. The first thing I think that was extremely helpful was it was just a very safe and different environment. Landed in January, it's 20 below zero in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It felt safe. And that's weird. Wouldn't have been my MO to say that, because I could self-will tough guy, but it did. I mentioned my world got really small, as ours do. I was a more out front person in business and life in general, but my alcoholism took it to a very, very small life. I was set into, unbeknownst to me at the time, a sober community. And at this point, it was just this, it was this house. It was more than a house. It was a sober, it was big. I think it housed 35 people probably. So it was a community, you know, it was a kitchen for everybody and people. I had a roommate that I would talk to. I was in this community of people with a counselor in places I needed or was supposed to be, which I needed to do. Because I had done it life and at houses and businesses, and I was down to not talking to a lot of people and not making my bed. I just to do just the basic stuff.
What were the other things that you needed to do as a part of this community? Now you are a part of. Your world had become very small. You come to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and it blows up.
Yeah.
It blows up.
Yeah.
And that's something that you haven't felt in a really long time. What else is part of doing this deal?
Oh,
what
man.
Did you need to do as part of this community?
Well, I needed to participate. I needed to get income. I needed a job. There were people to support me. I mean, like emotionally and nudge me, encourage me.
Did you go back to the service industry?
I did, but I did it because I knew it. And I worked as a cook and an assistant to this woman who ran this place because I knew a lot of stuff to help her. But she loved to have me there. And no, it wasn't any. I wasn't serving alcohol or any of that stuff. It was a family restaurant. It was a job. I had to be there.
What did that provide you with?
It provided me with income. It provided me with a place to be. It provided me with a commitment to make. I worked 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. It had me in a routine and a regimen. It had me free in the evenings. And it had me, again, remember the air brakes I like to put on the day, the get right part? That little button was still there. I'd work hard all day. And I said, and I had this little Honda, and this is the truth. I would leave work at 2 o'clock. I would feel that thing going, my motor running for that direction, and I was conscious of it. I don't know how I would have processed that otherwise, but I would drive right up the freeway and into that garage and into that sober house, and I would, what the drink gave me. But I felt, okay, this thing is conquered for now. But then I learned that I might nap, shower, shave, and then it was back into this community, and there were some of us that were going to recovery meetings. There were some of those people that were doing that, and I knew I needed to do this. All new, but there was a group of people, and maybe some days I led, let's go. Maybe some days they led, I don't know. Thank God I was in a community.
What about these recovery meetings specifically? What about them was most helpful, and what wasn't helpful about them? Let's start with what was helpful.
What was helpful is, at first, it is so different today, but it was a place to be and a place to learn about what was going on. You know, I walked into a recovery room thinking they were going to talk about not drinking. So, and that's, for somebody in recovery, they might get that tongue-in-cheek thing, but I learned, there were people to greet me and people to identify, and they were glad to see me back, and they might have been a graduate of the sober house I lived in. There were like these little connections that started happening, and I was out in life again, and I was there, at the very least, to start this journey. I was there. I was a part of something. I had a title, but I was a part of something. That was the start of the journey. I started listening, picking up chips, things.
What is picking up chips to those that don't know what you're talking about?
It was just sobriety landmarks. 30, 60, 90 days, 6 months. People made a big deal out of me, and I kind of thought that was cool.
Now, what are your thoughts? Why is that important to get those landmarks, to get those chips?
I was to learn later it was also to help other people, but at the time I'm not positive that I understood all that, but I was getting to there. But it was a goal. It was a thing. It was something I was proud of. I could literally see the difference in me at 30 days and me at 90 days. I was like, my goodness, some of these things that I remember them telling me are true. I have a job, I have this, or some of this post-acute withdrawal stuff they told me I would have that might clear up is. So I saw value in this thing. I was learning about the recovery part of this process, and it was a process. I did not have someone, or did not, and I don't know that the someone's was, or I did not ask someone in this way. And I said, grab me and set me down in a corner and open a book and start telling me the nature of my problem. I was learning it. But I was there. I was there a lot. Then I met more people, and my buddy from treatment and I hooked up. He was doing the deal. So I started just doing the deal, as we call it. You know, I started doing the deal. And I found out more from this guy, more from this guy. Well, he's doing this. Oh, he's working some steps. He's doing this, you say. And, I should get a sponsor. Oh, I should do these things. Sounds fundamental, because it was. I went to the meeting for fellowship, to learn something, to show up, because girls were there. Whatever reason you want.
Whatever gets me through the door.
That's right.
Come all the way in and sit all the way down.
Yeah, whatever it was.
What wasn't helpful about these meetings? When people talk about recovery meetings, it's all these wonderful things that they provide. You don't always hear about the negatives. What wasn't helpful about these
meetings? Boy, you know, you're talking to a guy that doesn't occur to me much, okay? So I'm going to confess that is the truth. That's how I feel about it today. What helpful was I up to anyway, you know, to not go? I don't know. Perhaps I was learning that there were some meetings that I thought were better than others. And in some cases, I was wrong. And in some cases, maybe I was right. It happens. I didn't hold it against this recovery group. I was to learn. I just, you know.
That statement completely resonates with me and my experience. However, yeah. What would you say to someone that isn't finding these meetings helpful, that has a bone to pick with certain recovery meetings, that is resisting? What would you say to that person?
I'd say if you feel that way, then you're probably in exactly the right place, because we all probably did. Most of us probably did at one time or another evaluate what we thought we were different from. I'd say keep coming back. I'd say, you know, maybe in my case, maybe my ideas need to be questioned. Given my track record up to that point, I don't like to hurt men's feelings I work with, but sometimes we have to talk about that. Maybe there's more than you get to see right now, and maybe your choices of what you like and don't like might not be the top of your concern list today. Maybe let's give somebody a chance. Or if you don't like it, meet me at 6:30 tomorrow morning and I'll show you another great meeting. And they'll usually say, no, I'm okay. I don't know how to answer that question other than millions of people have recovered in the various recovery programs we have. So maybe it's worth opening my mind for a minute. And you know what? If it's not your thing, try something else, I suppose. It's okay. I mean, I suppose. I'm not the decider today, thank God, of everybody's journey. But we'll be here if you want to come back. We will be here. You know, open your arms. I don't know. I say maybe we had to let go of our old ideas. And that's true. This is true. My walking into that process, my preferences or needs or thoughts were a little askew. I've been living in a pretty needy what's good for me. Let me decide what's good for me world. Maybe just give us a chance. Maybe turn that. Try it again. Try us again. And do it again tomorrow too.
You said something very profound that I hear just about every day. However, a lot of people don't hear what you just said a minute ago. You said, if you are struggling with this, if you are having a hard time, if you are resisting this, then you are probably in the right place. And Dwight is exactly in the right place at the right time in this moment with me here in Studio One at KFAI. We are going to take a short break and we will be right back.
So long, it's not true. Wanted a woman, never bargained for you. Lots of people talking, few of them know. Soul of a woman was created below.
Welcome back to Authentic. We are here with Dwight C. Before we took that break, you were discussing how things were progressing. No one knows this from listening to this recording, but relapse is a part of your story.
Absolutely. It is.
How long did you have sober before you relapsed?
You know, I counted it in years in that time. I had a dozen years. I had a bad accident, was on medications and things, and I called that a relapse, and then another dozen, 13 years. So, from the time I left Hazelden. So, I mean, I had a good life, a good recovery, a good thing. Yeah. I mean, it is.
You hear it in the rooms of these recovery meetings, mm-hmm. that this person went back out.
That's
how they mention this relapse thing.
Right.
This relapse word that's thrown around.
Uh-huh.
What would you say to people that have relapsed so they don't stay out if they've gone back out? Because there are so many people that go back out, stay out, and die.
Absolutely. Many.
What do you say to those that have gone back out or are still out as someone that has gone through a relapse?
Yeah. If they could get their head around the idea that whatever they thought they experienced before, they could experience again. I mean, there's no doubt about it, but we have to take the journey, you know, and hopefully we get a chance. I would say that if you personally have come to the point that you know you aren't managing it, can't manage it, or hurting all the other people, then whatever you thought you might have had, first of all, they about me or me about everybody else, A, they're not thinking about you in that bad person point of view, and certainly not as much as I felt about myself. Second of all, they're just, you know, glad to see you. I mean, and third, it's before the Undertaker, it's the last house on the block. I mean, and it certainly is in my world, I'm here to say. But you know, it's a strange and harsh prospect for addicted people. Because I mentioned when I take substances into my body, I'm bodily and mentally different from other normal people, as we call them. So my decision process changes on that based on addiction, really, you know, in a lot of ways. I can fix this, might come back in. I can figure this out, might come back in. It's not that bad, might come back in. It's a process. Certainly was for me. This is bad, but I can stop this. These I words, I can do it, sets back in. Recovery world's a big we world. It involves higher powers and people, vulnerability or sociability, there's a whole thing. And addiction, at least certainly for me, shrinks all that right away. I'm in a different world, and I'm thinking about doing whatever the substance is, or I'm thinking about not doing whatever the substance is. I'm thinking of telling this person. I'm thinking of not telling this person. You see, it's this mad realm of thought and shame. Let's use, I'm ashamed. I no longer have decades, sobriety, whatever thing. It's a mixed up formula of nothing. Really, you know, other than my own thoughts and feelings about it, it can stop. There is help. I've seen it many times. Relapse, went back out. You know, I suppose that's whatever they call it. I'm not a fan of the slip word, the S word, only because I don't experience things that look like slips. I don't see any banana peels sitting around, you know, so... And I don't think that my friends, business associates, or family would care to call something a slip that they've experienced with me. And I did. The decision might be a slip of judgment.
And then after,
slip of spirituality.
And then after the slip, after then what
that,
happens?
Yeah,
you slip, that. And then...
Yeah. You start colliding with people, places, things. Maybe hospitals, some people jails, I don't know, yeah.
So that but doesn't happen to you. What do you do personally to further and nourish your own sobriety, Dwight?
Certainly my beginning, because this started 4 or 5 years ago, this slip, it was a slip into the world of prescribed medications, but they have a funny similarity to my first drug. You know, it turns out I had a real error of judgment, and as I mentioned to groups, I sensed that I was being none too smart when I said, okay, that I will take narcotic painkillers in my case. And I fully intended to not do it shortly. But that's not what it's like for us, people like me. It's just not like that. Because I'll just re-decide that my addiction kind of re-decides for me told people in the treatment center that helped me, they wanted to address it as pain management. And the truth is it was addiction management in short order. You understand? It might have had the word pain on the bottle, but it was addiction management from then on. And so what would you say what about how to address it?
How are you furthering and nourishing your own sobriety?
Yeah, okay. Well, I got the body and mind cleansed. I got help right away. After I realized I wasn't going to figure it out, that was the thing. And I jumped into community again. I knew there was a program of recovery. I knew there was a better life there. I was blessed. I had gotten to experience that in my life and experience what recovery and helping other people felt like. The issue was, a couple of years ago, is that I was not there. I was painfully, another grace moment of the collision of, I knew what I needed if I could just do it, but I wasn't. I also was painfully aware that I wasn't there and I was hurting other people in the order. So I threw myself into a program of recovery. I surrendered to the fact that whatever I knew over 25 years was wonderful. And I would be able to use that someday, but not right now.
There's this paradox that exists in the recovery community where in order to help yourself, you have to help other people. Yeah. All of a sudden you get outside of yourself and it taps you on the shoulder and it says, hey, you know that thing you needed help with? Well, you got outside of your own head, you went and helped somebody else, and hey, here's the answer. Hey, here's the help.
Yeah.
What are you doing to help other people that struggle, that are still in the fight, that are in the thick of it? Because I'm not trying to say that you are not in the fight. You're further away from getting your ass kicked.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're still in the arena.
Oh, yeah. I'm very blessed to be in the arena.
How are you helping the people that are getting their fucking asses kicked?
Well, I'm very blessed to be in the arena. I'm very blessed that anybody would hand me opportunities. That's one thing. I know it's a blessing. And, you know, and I will help. I've learned that I'm supposed to be helping everybody in every arena also, not just holding the door for the old lady. I'm supposed to remember that in relationships or people, you know, what do you need? How are you doing? Changes me. It's crazy. Is that paradox you're talking about? Yeah, I was very there's a treatment center, I guess you call it, they call it a spiritual center, actually it's not a treatment center, here in Minneapolis, and it's very, very recovery based, book centered place. They go back to the old theory that my program started with, that in order to keep this, faith without works is dead unless I do it, and then I get to experience it. I don't experience it in my head, man. I don't do it. I get to experience it out here. I'm experiencing it right now, talking to you. I don't know, helping you, but, and there were people that offered me opportunities immediately when I left. And I was told by the men who came there from recovery programs is that you need to come back here with us. And I mean next week, not next month. It starts right now. And they were speaking my language. Okay, I know this. I'm not doing it, but I know it. I know it. I'm going, wow, there's hope. Yes, they're right. More yeses than noes, as we say. More yeses than noes. So I started doing it, and I had friends that encouraged me to do it, and people started handing me things, and I started saying yes. Today, I'm a very blessed guy in a recovery program that offers me opportunities daily. I meet newcomers. I meet new guys. I meet old guys. I'm involved with this recovery center. Man, I don't know. I pick up people at airports. I drop them off. I take them to detox. I pick them up at detox. I get to talk to them. I get to have lunch with them. I go meet them. I meet with them. I sponsor them. I'll be doing a workshop for this place, and it's not to be a big deal. I just said, I'm just blessed. I can't believe that from the person that was, whether it's 30 years ago or the spot pickle I was sitting in a couple of years ago, that I get to do this. It's just mind-blowing to me that I get the chance to help somebody else and see that light come on, to take my practical experience, because that's all I really have. I mean, I'm not the guru of anything. I'm not. I'm just a guy who's seen it, done it, sees it all the time. And I get to tell guys, here's just what I see and here's what I've done. We were talking about that during a break. Somebody will ask me, a guy or it's guys, how'd you know that was going to happen? Or how do you know this is going to happen? And my best answer is because I've done it. I've done this. I've seen it. I've done it. This worked. This didn't. You know,
it, there are so many people that we encounter that don't make it back, that I was alluding to earlier. So many people suffering from addiction die prematurely to means of suicide, overdose, any multitude of ways, really. Why didn't you? Why aren't you one of those people that has left us?
Well, that's certainly a legitimate question. You hear that all the time in recovery, too. And it's true. I mean, people say, I could have died. Well, duh. You know? Yeah, we could have. I personally was not blessed not to be suicidal. I've gotten to spots where it seemed like an option. I don't know. You know, I got that opportunity to see recovery. And so that's the part that never went away. Though when I was lost in the wilderness a few years ago and I didn't have it, there's a knowing that it was there. You know, there's a, I don't know what's around the next corner. You know, I would tell somebody, okay, here's something that I experienced for someone who was in recovery and was back out there, was one of the questions you asked me. Okay, and I would say, well, what happened in the recovery? What happened? Well, this, this, and this. And by the way, life gets better. Okay, let's just know this. And whatever description that is. The question a guy asked me, was talking to me, he goes, well, why not now? You didn't see any of that better coming the first time or the second time. So whoever you met, whatever you closer to God or got a job or found a house or whatever you experienced, did you know you were going to get all that when you started recovering the first time, let's say? My answer was no, of course not. I was cooking in a restaurant for a woman. The legitimate question was, so why do you think that's not there now? Our book says we are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. So it won't be the old freedom and the old happiness. It won't be the misery you have right now, you see? So just wrap your head around, why can't, if you didn't know it was going to be great, and then it got horrible and you're hurting right now, and I get it, why do you think you know it's not going to be great again? Why do you not know who you're going to get to meet? Hey, maybe it'll be better. I don't know. But you don't know either.
And that is my favorite statement in recovery circles, because it is so true, and it's okay to say, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But there are some people that do know. They know at least a little bit more than me, and they can take me along as long as I ask them to. As long as I am honest, open, and willing, that hand is there for me, no matter what. Dwight, I posed a question to you before we even got started, and I told you to think about it a little bit, because it's a fairly deep question, and I ask all of my interviewees this question. What do you want your legacy as a human being to be? You aren't one of those statistics. You didn't die from overdose. You didn't commit suicide. What do you want your legacy as a human being to be?
That's a great question. As a person, and very much as a father of two daughters that I didn't know I would have, things like that, you know, with life. But as a person, I would love to be, for their sake, not mine, because I'll be gone, but that I was a good father, but that I showed up. And that's the tragic thing about addiction. That's one of the bottom hurtful things, is my emotional, physical, whatever, absence of someone who learned to show up. Go all the way back to the driveway with my brother and the hurt because I wasn't showing up except with just a load of crap. I would like to be the person for them, for alcoholics who need help or alcoholics that don't need help. I'd like to be on your list, not for my ego, just I'd like to be that person. That if you think of something that needed, you know, let's try Dwight C., because if he can do it, he will. You know, if he can't, he can't. But let me think of him as somebody that, yeah, I just want to be one of those guys. For you, for the recovery center, or for my kids. I can call him, because part of recovery, for me, has been that I'm not that person, you see. And I can show somebody else. They're never going to get to see the person I was, but I'm not that person. But I was.
You said earlier in our interview, that's not recovery. It just started my wheels turning, and I want to know, in just a few words, real basic, what is recovery?
Ah, I guess we'll use I don't want to use people's terms for it. I'll say sobriety. There's not using, of course. But no, there's a recovery for me. For me, it's getting a sponsor and going through a program of recovery where going through this process of uncover, recover, and discard. In other words, I've learned about me better and how I've shown up and how I tend to go and my flaws in my character. It's through a process of surrender and inventory, learning how I've reacted to life and how I tend to react to people and can do today. I go to a higher power. I call God and ask for help to not do that. And I'm recovering. It's interesting. I'm a changed man. I might do it again tonight, but I've been given a recovery process to see it versus never seeing it. I'm just a jerk, you know? Understand what I'm saying? So that's recovery. Recovery is going, yeah, I'm a flawed person. You know, people do this in religions. People do these things all over the world. Some people don't do it without being brought to their knees. Some of us addicts and alcoholics, we just got to be brought to our knees. But yeah, there's a recovery that goes from the saying in one of our stories in our book, you know, the guy says, hey, Ma, ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing? That's just because I quit drinking. You know, it's all good. No, I want to recover. I need to change and find it desirable. Find it desirable that I would like to change. I didn't do that very well. I'd really love to do it better. And today I have a God to ask help me do that. There's a relationship that's started. So there's more than me now. I don't do this alone anymore.
That is the most powerful thing for anyone. Even if you're not dealing with addiction, just dealing with life. That's why the whole idea behind this program is exploring all things recovery. Because if you are still living and breathing on this earth, you are in recovery from something. And we don't do it alone. This is our collective. This is our life. This isn't my life. This isn't Nick's world. This isn't Dwight's world. This is our world. This is our experience. And that is where the true strength, the true foundation of recovery lies. Recovery is we. Dwight, thank you so much for coming on the program today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's been such a privilege to have you.
Yeah, well, my experience, what can I tell you?
Hey, you know it well.
It's a beautiful thing.
All right, that is all the time we have. As always, we have to pay credit where credit is due. To open the show, as always, we heard Mad Madness by Muse. Then we heard a little Voodoo Child by Jimi Hendrix. Then we heard a little Dazed and Confused by Zeppelin. To send us off, Dwight C. has picked Roseanne Cash and Bruce Springsteen, the Boss, Sea of Heartbreak. Thank you so much for joining us here on Authentic. Please remember, always be good to yourselves. It is ever so important.
Come to my rescue. Sea of tears.